Welcome to The Point. It's our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top news stories of the week with my colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me here in our Woods Hole studio is Anne Brennan. She's the digital editor at the Cape Cod Times and CapeCodOnline.com and president of the New England Society of News Editors. Good morning, Anne.
Morning, Sean.
And joining us a little later will be Tim Wood, the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Sally Rose, editor of the Provincetown Banner, Jim DeRuta, editorial page editor of the New Bedford Standard Times, and Nelson Siegelman, editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times, and I'm Sean Corcoran. And big news for in the town of Falmouth, where the Supreme Judicial Court has decided it will not take up an appeal of a court ruling that pretty much puts in question the future of the two town-owned wind turbines in Falmouth, which have been so controversial, with neighbors complaining about noise and of health effects from those turbines. Some neighbors, not all, of course. But so this has been in the courts for a while. Now it looks like the town is out of options. It has to go back to the zoning board, its own zoning board, and get approval for those turbines. But a lot of rules have changed in the town since this first happened. And so in 2013, town meeting prohibited turbines of more than 250 kilowatts. So that's about six times the size of the two existing turbines. So it's not clear what the next step will be. But it does seem like the neighbors have scored a significant win here in the effort to have those turbines removed.
Right. And from the very beginning, there were issues with how these turbines were allowed to be built. There were neighbors who were saying that once they came up, that they weren't really aware that this was happening and that the noise and the kind of flickering of the light was causing health effects making them unhealthy. And so they really put up a big fight, and it turns out that the court ruled they should have had these permits and gone through a permitting process.
The town was saying, look, these were town-owned turbines. They were going to be on town-owned property, and they are on town-owned property. We didn't need certain permits from the town. We're exempt from that. And the court has said, no, you did need those permits. There's a specific wind turbine bylaw in town, so that should have been an indication. You need to go to the zoning board for this stuff. They didn't do that. To now go retroactively is, boy, I've never seen anything like that. It should be quite the question.
Right, and there's financial implications as well, because at one point they were looking at taking the turbines down, but they did receive some money from the state to build these turbines, and if they took them down, they would still be on the hook for all that money. So I can't really remember what the number was. It was in the millions of dollars that it would cost the town to take these turbines down.
Well, that was part of the problem. There were a lot of questions about what really is the real number
right.
that it's going to cost to take these down. And they're not even fully paid for, is my understanding. So one thing that's interested me throughout this, feelings are so high over this. Some people just don't believe the neighbors. Others do believe the neighbors. What was interesting to me when we did a lot of reporting about this was several of the neighbors who ended up complaining about potential health effects or impacts on them supported those turbines going up. They thought that they would be a great symbol of renewable energy, and it wasn't until they were turned on that they suddenly like, whoa, what's happening here? And then they eventually became objected to their presence there. And I think that that's gone. You know, a lot of people didn't realize that. They thought it was just, oh, not in my backyard from the very start. But that's from my reporting, that wasn't necessarily the case.
And I think the other thing that happened with this project is that we had a lot of momentum for our on-land wind turbines on Cape Cod. There were several municipalities that wanted to put them up because it would defray the cost of energy for them. And once this happened, it really turned the tide for wind projects on the Cape. And we've seen a lot more solar come up as a result of that, I believe. But it really did make a change in many other ways.
Well, hindsight is 20/20, of course, but you have to wonder if perhaps the Patrick administration mishandled this and didn't quite address what was happening in Falmouth early on and say, yeah, perhaps something is happening there. Maybe it's an anomaly, maybe not, but let's take a close look at it. There was some of that conversation, but it took a while. And so neighbors felt like they were kind of on their own with this thing. And you're right. Those neighbors, not only do they go out across the Cape to different meetings here and proposals regarding wind turbines, they went across the state. They were up in Salem, Massachusetts, where they're considering putting turbines. And to have them come in and share their story, I think really created a chilling effect on the efforts to install wind turbines across the Commonwealth. And solar has picked up on some of that renewable energy efforts. But what's happened in Falmouth has been truly remarkable. Let's move on to Obama. President Obama, reporting from the Cape Cod Times today, is that he will be returning to the vineyard this summer for vacation. Interesting how this story kind of came out.
Right. The National Guard Colonel James Lefevre, who is the head of Joint Base Cape Cod, was pretty much making a presentation, briefing the Mashpee Selectmen Board of Selectmen this week. And he mentioned that the Obama family will be coming once again to Martha's Vineyard. They'll be landing at the base, and that people might see more of a presence of fighter jets, which no longer are stationed here. They had been in the past, but just kind of giving a heads up about that. We did call the White House. They did not want to. They said, we have no announcement at this time. But for all but 2012, since President Obama was elected, he has been vacationing about the middle 2 weeks of August on Martha's Vineyard. Sometimes it's a longer visit, there have been shorter visits, but it's at least about 10 days to 2 weeks. And based on previous years, we can expect a lot of golf playing.
What type of access does the local media get to the president?
Well, there's you could be with the press pool that different organizations apply to be with the press pool. And normally they would take one or two from the Massachusetts area, Boston, and they would then follow the president around for the day on his different whatever he's doing. But a lot of times you're in a bus or in a building or something waiting for him to finish golf or to eat or whatever the president is doing that day. We tend not to do the pool in the last few years just because of that, and we've been trying to find, you know, different stories, either trying to find where the president is and cover it from afar, or, you know, knocking on a neighbor's door and who lives near a golf course and ask if we can, you know, use their backyard to take some pictures. But also to find out what else is going on around the town, because it's a big impact on Martha's Vineyard when the president does come to town because of the security.
Absolutely. It sure is. And it seems to be different with this president versus President Bill Clinton when he came. And he seemed to be out and about a lot more. There was some golf playing there as well.
Right.
It doesn't seem to be quite as much. Let's talk about these new rules to protect sharks. I guess I hadn't even considered that this was an issue. They're looking to protect the great white sharks from folks who, I guess, just want to take a look at them.
Right. Or who want to attract them to get a look at them by chumming, putting bits of fish and blood in the water and hoping to attract them. And as of yesterday, there's new rules that makes that illegal without a permit from the state. Greg Scolmo, who is the chief marine biologist for the state Division of Marine Fisheries, says that when people attract the sharks to them by using food, that can make an association in the shark's mind between a human and food. So it can change a shark's behavior and make it a more dangerous situation for people. And so that is no longer legal. There are fines up to $10,000 if you break this new rule. There are the chumming can continue for people who are commercial or recreational fishermen. That's just what they do that for tuna, I guess. But to just go out and try and attract sharks without a permit is now illegal.
And let's stay with sea life here for a few more stories. NOAA proposes a new status for humpback whales.
Right. They want to take the 10 of 14 populations worldwide of the humpback whales, including the West Indies population, which swims through the Cape waters, and take them off the endangered or protected species list. They say that currently there's about 12,000 West Indies humpback whales, and that about 3% of them are dying annually from entanglement with fishermen equipment or other gear, and another small percent are fatally injured by boats, collisions with vessels. So they think that it would be not harmful to the species to remove them from this designation. And federal officials are saying that by doing this, they would be able to focus on marine species that are in more trouble population-wise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, someone was quoted in the story as saying, hey, look, yeah, someone in favor of removing them from the endangered species list, this is a real feather in the cap of NOAA. It should be celebrated, the growth in these populations, and also is noted that they would continue to be protected by the Marine Mammal Protection Act.
Right, but there are people who, like David Dow, the Sierra Club, mm-hmm. who feels that this is a short-sighted decision if it is made. This was at a meeting because there's a 90-day public comment period. This was a public hearing about this to go over these new proposed plan. And he was saying that, they're not taking into consideration global climate change. And so that he feels that taking these whales off the list would is short-sighted.
I see. We've seen a few stories in recent weeks about poaching, particularly black sea bass poaching. And, of course, the season for black sea bass is not open yet. Won't be until August.
Well, it's not open it'll be open for commercial fishermen in August. But I guess for recreational fishermen, it opened May 23rd, excuse me. And even before the season opened, the environmental police had four cases of poaching, three of which were in the last 2 weeks. Currently, under the law, you can only take 8 black bass per person. There's a limit on fishing, and they must be at least 14 inches long. On these cases, on May 18th, a captain has been summoned to court. He was in possession of 107 black sea fish, 19 of which were under legal size. And a week later, a Brockton man was arrested for marine OUI, allegedly driving while under the influence. And he was found to have 122 black sea bass, and some of which were undersized. And he had an expired commercial fishing license, but was not,
valid.
Legal. He could not legally catch the fish.
Yeah, might as well have a library card. I mean,
right. The reason why this is important this time of year is that it's the spawning season, so you want to keep as many, allow the fish to reproduce. And generally, if you're limited to 8 fish per person, that is something that can work well with that and not threaten the population. But even if you are a commercial fisherman with a license, you can only catch 150 to 300 pounds of fish per time that you go out, depending on the type of equipment you're using. And the total amount of weight that will be caught this year is about 290,000 pounds. Once that's caught, the commercial fisheries is closed until next year.
Okay, let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to continue discussing the local news here on the Point News Roundup, and we'll be joined by Tim Wood, the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on WCAI. We're discussing the top news stories of the week. I'm Sean Corcoran, and with me in our Woods Hole studio is Ann Brennan of the Cape Cod Times, and joining us on the phone is Tim Wood, the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Hello, Tim.
Good morning, Sean.
Good morning, Tim. Bring us back to the story of skydiving in the town of Chatham.
Yeah, this is the story that kind of never goes away. It continues to be as controversial as ever, and this week we had a few new developments, which will further the story along a little bit and maybe add some fuel to the fire. As we talked about before, the town is under orders from the Federal Aviation Administration to put out a request for proposals for skydiving companies interested in working out of the Chatham Airport here. A few weeks ago, they sent the FAA about a 30-page request for proposals, an RFP, which sought to pretty much severely restrict skydiving, and that was rejected outright by the FAA, told the town basically go back to the drawing board. This past Tuesday, the Board of Selectmen approved a stripped-down RFP, three or four pages long, very basic, in order to meet a June 12th deadline that the FAA had set for doing that. Now, if the FAA approves that, the town will have 14 days to issue the RFP, and potential skydive vendors then have 45 days to submit proposals. And if you look at the timing on that, that puts us really into August. So it's unlikely that there's going to be any skydiving in Chatham this summer, because even once proposals are submitted, there's got to be a time for contract negotiations. Mm-hmm. So looks like the people who oppose skydiving are going to get through another summer without worrying about it. And that kind of assumes that Skydive Cape Cod, which was the previous skydive operator here, doesn't file a lawsuit to halt the whole process. Just recently, the company's attorney informed the town that his client believed that the last contract that they had with the town, which dates back to 2013, they believe that there was a renewal clause in there, and they believe that's still valid, and they're planning to file a lawsuit. But as of yesterday, they hadn't taken any action yet, so we're keeping an eye on that. Also, the other development in this story is safety, of course, has always been the main issue that skydiving opponents have raised. And the town, too, has kind of prodded the FAA on this issue. They've been seeking a safety assessment of skydiving at the Chatham Airport for a couple of years now. And Tuesday, the selectmen decided that they're not going to wait for the FAA or the state to conduct that safety assessment. They're going to commission an independent safety assessment of the airport, which they think will put them in a better position to establish parameters when and if a new skydiving contract is negotiated. So that's where we are with that, and we're keeping our ears open on several fronts there, and hoping that this issue could be resolved by the end of the summer.
Okay, let's move on to a different story. This is one about an ancient graveyard in Chatham. Looks like a road's going to come pretty close to that. Is that the deal there?
Yeah, the road is already in place. It's been there for a long time. It's basically what happened was, excuse me, last spring, a number of people were kind of shocked to see that this road, Old Queen Anne Road, as it goes down towards Main Street, they were shocked to see that a gravestone in the old Baptist Cemetery, which abuts this road, the gravestone was pretty much almost hanging over the roadway. In the spring, sewers were placed down the center of the road, and as part of that project, the roadway was slightly realigned to create space for sidewalks on the east side of the roadway. But in doing so, a hill on the west side that goes up to the cemetery had to be cut back. And when that was done, the bank was cut back so far that it literally comes within a few inches of a gravestone that dates from 1776. Now, highway officials say that all the work that they did to realign that roadway was done within the right-of-way of the roadway, and that the headstone just happens to be on the very edge of the cemetery property. Now, when they did the excavation work, they offered assurances that there were no bodies or no bones, no relics or anything were found at that time. But a lot of people were a little skeptical of that. They were also kind of shocked at how close that gravestone was. The highway department is in the process of doing a couple things. Number one, apparently Queen Anne Road is a designated scenic road, and a hearing was supposed to be held for the removal of trees along that way, which never happened, and the planning board is now pushing for that to happen in retrospect. And also, at least one person in town, a woman named Elaine Gibbs, has done a ton of research on this, and she said that the highway department should have received permission from both the historical commission in town and even the state to do this work so close to the ancient cemetery, which is the cemetery dates to pre-colonial times. Right now, there's about 48 old headstones in it. A lot of them are in poor repair. A lot of them are on the ground, and the cemetery commission says they don't even particularly know where all the bodies are buried in that cemetery because it's pretty old. And so at the point, this point right now, the local historical commission is working with the community development department, the highway department, to identify other historical and archaeological resources in town, kind of to make sure that this situation doesn't occur again, that they have a little bit more warning when some work is going to be done so close to one of those resources. So they're waiting to come up with that sort of process, and the highway department is looking at the plans that they use to see if indeed they took down any trees that they shouldn't have in that area. So this is, again, a continuing story, but it's people who have been driving down that road are a little shocked to see that headstone so close to the roadway.
Sure, understandable. Tim Wood is the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle and a regular here on the Roundup. You can follow Tim and the Chronicle on Twitter at CCC Newsroom. Thank you very much, Tim.
Thank you, Sean.
And joining me in our Woods Hole studio is Ann Brennan of the Cape Cod Times. Ann, there was an interesting march on what was it, this past weekend?
Right.
In Hyannis.
Right. It was called the No More Men's March, and it was aimed at reducing domestic violence. This is part of a white ribbon effort, a campaign that's been going on for the last few years, encouraging men to get involved with preventing domestic violence. There were about 100 people who participated in the march. It was a fundraiser for Independence House, which is a Hyannis-based nonprofit that supports domestic violence victims. And one of the speakers was comedian Ben Atherton Zeman, who is a trainer on violence prevention issues, and he talked to the crowd and said that in the United States there is an act of abuse every 12 seconds, a rape every 2 minutes, and nearly every second of the day there's there are derogatory comments, catcalls, and gender discrimination. He said, well, that's sad news. The good news is that the number of men who don't rape and who don't do these things outnumber the ones who do, and he's just encouraging people to continue to work to prevent domestic violence.
I can remember covering Take Back the Night marches, which were typically all women who were out
right there
to speak and to speak out about this issue. It's interesting now to see men marching as well.
Yeah, and Lynn Hood Glidden, a Cape resident, said she wanted to thank the men for that because, as she said, we walked for years to take back the night. Mm-hmm. Now the men are giving it back to us.
Okay. Sally Rose is joining us on the phone. Sally, of course, is the editor of the Provincetown Banner. Hello, Sally.
Hi, Sean.
Sally, a story. Hillary Clinton, presidential candidate, will be coming to Provincetown in early July.
That's right. Big news for the little Outer Cape here, and I guess she's also planning some visits around various other parts of the Cape. So it's, as you said, taking place on July 2nd, and it's being billed here as an afternoon conversation and reception. And the details concerning location and exact time have yet to be disclosed, but according to local organizers, a host committee is being formed to plan all that. And it's being hosted locally here by Brian Raffinelli and Alex Ritchie. Alex Ritchie is, of course, the Banner's esteemed former owner and publisher. She told us she couldn't be more excited and honored that Clinton is coming here for this event. And Raffinelli also was very excited and fundamental in bringing the campaign and Clinton here. He's an event planner who has worked with Clinton since 2010 to plan the family's personal celebrations, including their daughter Chelsea's wedding. So, and he owns a home here in Provincetown.
Do we see many presidential candidates in Provincetown?
You know, we haven't. In 2012, Vice President Joe Biden came during Obama's reelection for a fundraiser, and that was up at the Pilgrim Monument Provincetown Museum. But no, not to my knowledge, there haven't been too many.
Ann Brennan?
Well, prior to Hillary Clinton heading to Provincetown, she's going to be at a part of her Conversation with Hillary fundraiser at the Osterville home of Elaine and Gerald Schuster to raise funds that earlier in that day.
And when you cover something like this, it's basically hang out outside, hope you get a photo. I mean, there's really not much interaction, especially during fundraisers, right?
Right. Usually the press does not attend any fundraisers. They're not invited.
I wonder why. Sally, you mentioned to me in an email that you have a story about some residents receiving some awards, pretty significant.
Yeah, this is really nice. We're just bursting with pride out here because two of the Outer Cape residents learned recently that they've earned these prestigious honors. Longtime Wellfleet resident Barbara Prazak, she's the medical director at Outer Cape Health Services. She's going to be honored this Friday because she's been selected as this year's Outstanding Massachusetts Community Health Center Physician.
Oh.
And that's by the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers. Okay. She's been at Outer Cape for like 25, 26 years, the last five as the top doc there. And she still sees patients with all the duties of the medical director. She still sees patients weekly at all three of the health centers in Wellfleet, Provincetown, and Harwich. And that award will be given at the Community Health Center League's Awards Gala on Friday, June 5th. That's at the Weston Copley Place in Boston. So, and then, Sean, the other one is a middle school teacher at Provincetown Schools, David McLaughlin. He's a Provincetown resident, and he was chosen as the 2015 Massachusetts History Teacher of the Year by the Gilder Lehrman Institute of American History, and that's based in New York City.
Hmm.
And he was selected from about 300 applicants, and that award ceremony will be held June 11th at the State House in Boston.
Okay, well, congratulations to them, and a big thank you to Sally Rose, a regular on the roundup here. Thank you very much, Sally.
Thank you, Sean.
Okay. Ann Brennan is here from the Cape Cod Times, and there's an effort underway in Sandwich. Sandwich has an interesting little visitor center, and by little, it's almost like
a booth.
A booth. And they want to change that, so they have an ambitious fundraising campaign going on.
Right. This is the visitors. They want to open a year-round visitor center on Route 130, right behind where the booth is right now. They hope to have a 2,000 square foot building that includes restrooms, which is a big issue for the town for visitors. Currently, they use porta potties, but that's always problematic and usually not the most satisfying experience. Memorial Day weekend, though, there were some teen pranksters who rendered the porta potties unusable, and they'd really like to get away from that situation, but also have this building or visitor center that would be staffed.
Right.
They're raising $296,000. They have all but $60,000, so they launched this week a campaign to raise $60,000 in 60 days.
Okay. Yeah, that'll be interesting. Get some bathrooms at the visitor center.
Right.
Well, it is one of the first places you can stop once you get over onto the Cape.
Right.
You know, exit 2, I believe it is.
Yes. And, you know, the they don't just serve visitors who come, and there'll probably be brochures and they can get information about different areas of the Cape and especially Sandwich. But
right.
There's also people who come to Sandwich for a doctor appointment or something else that also could use some help with directions. So they're aiming it at more than just visitors.
Let's go to the phone where Jim DeRuta is joining us, and Jim is the editorial page editor of the New Bedford Standard Times. Hello, Jim.
Good morning, Sean.
Good morning. I've been looking forward to this conversation. Big news yesterday with the announcement that New Bedford will be the sailing venue for the Boston 2024 Olympics proposal.
Yes, if Boston wins their bid.
It seems like a really smart move on organizers' parts, people who are supportive of the Olympics, to kind of get interest drummed up outside of Boston. I think we've kind of just been watching the debate, but now it seems like this area has a stake in this.
Yes, Boston wasn't all too keen on it. If you remember over the winter when the MBTA had so much trouble, they said, how are we supposed to run an Olympics when we can't even run our trains? But they had originally wanted to put the sailing in Boston Harbor,
mm-hmm.
and New Bedford put together a team and put a full-court press, which included bringing in some of the consultants who have planned the sailing venues in previous Olympics, and it's kind of a slam dunk. Buzzards Bay is an awesome place to sail.
So What have you been hearing from people as this news has trickled out? Is it largely supported, or are we hearing some folks saying, hold on, maybe this isn't a good thing for New Bedford?
The mayor is pitching it as no downside, and while that is probably a little too optimistic, there's not a lot of downside. You know, the complaints that people usually have about Olympics is how much is going to be thrown on taxpayers, what's it going to cost when overruns and unexpecteds pop up. But the infrastructure that's needed to host the sailing competition here is simply some temporary stands on Fort Tabor, which is a remarkable viewing spot for sailing out in the Buzzards Bay. The housing for however many athletes and support are needed is already available at UMass Dartmouth and Tabor Academy. And, you know, the mayor has 2 years to market this before the IOC, International Olympic Committee, ever votes on who wins the bid for 2024.
And so any of that infrastructure left behind, any buildings or anything like that, if indeed this goes forward?
This, I think, in talking with one of the folks on the mayor's planning committee yesterday, I get the idea that there'll be maybe some extra slips and access, and that will simply be a benefit to the public once the Olympics are gone, because it will have brought more attention locally to the amenities, and it will bring more chances for people who don't get the chance to sail to come down and participate. He talked about how the Los Angeles Olympics of 84 had such a strong impact that an endowment was created, and it's still paying benefits and still bringing more people into sailing.
Yeah, it's interesting. And unlike most of the other sports in the Summer Olympics, the sailing teams would be here much early on. To test the waters and figure out what they were doing. I mean, you don't need to do that so much in volleyball and track. So it seemed like it'd be more of a duration of Olympic activity. Ann Brennan?
I know the local Chamber of Commerce, Wendy Northcross, had hoped that if this was indeed going to be the venue, that some of that would spill over to Cape Cod. As you say, these teams come into the area to train over the next few years leading up to the Olympics.
Jim Deruda, we need to take a quick break. Can you hang on for 1 minute? Because I want to talk about this Magnuson-Stevens Act reauthorization.
Certainly.
Okay, we're going to take just a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to continue talking about the local news of the week. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Point on WCAI. I'm Sean Corcoran, and Ann Brennan is here from the Cape Cod Times. On the phone, Jim Deruda of the New Bedford Standard Times. Jim, a lot of talk this week about the reauthorization of the Magnuson-Stevens Act, and that, of course, is the law that really regulates commercial fishing. What's happening there?
House passed the reauthorization on Monday, I think it was. And now it goes to the Senate. It was voted almost right down partisan lines. Only 5 Democrats voted in favor of it. 3 of them are the Democratic U.S. reps who cover Massachusetts coastline from up in Gloucester all the way around to Fall River. And it's those 3 representatives had gotten an amendment in that would take forfeiture money from violations in the fishery and apply it to building better science. It's a really strange situation, Sean. Both sides are saying we need better science, but it's really pitting the environmentalists and the fishermen against each other, and they both have extreme views of the other side's stance. The environmentalists think the fishermen want to take every last fish out of the sea, and the fishermen think the environmentalists want to turn the ocean into a zoo.
And this adversarial conflict has kind of been going on a long time between environmentalists, fishermen, and even regulators.
It has. And with this reauthorization, the environmentalists are opposed right now to what they say are rollbacks and laying in arbitrary times for rebuilding stocks. But we editorially at the paper have taken on that claim because the rebuilding period that's in the current act is an arbitrary 10-year deadline. And, you know, all the steps are being taken to pull more science in so that decisions can be made that make sense based on what's surveyed. The way NOAA has been surveying, we attended something from the Center for Sustainable Fisheries, a local group that's advocating for, you know, keeping the fishery going and keeping the communities healthy. They said that if scientific rigor were applied to NOAA's survey methods, their results would be rejected because they're taking such small samples over such large areas and with techniques that are intended to measure multiple species at one time instead of trying to check what's the ground fish look like, what's the scallops look like, what's the, you know, some of the choke species, so-called, like yellowtail flounder and cod.
Very complex. And Brennan, one of the things that they are doing right now is having monitors on certain boats, right? But there's a question about the money for that.
Well, because of a court ruling, NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, used to pay for monitors to be on boats. This has happened since 1972. It cost about $1.75 million. And these monitors make sure that commercial fishermen obey the rules. Mm-hmm. Because of this court ruling, the cost of that is going to be put back on the fishing industry. Representative William Keating has been working with some key House of Representative members to get the $1.75 million into the NOAA budget for this purpose. And at this point, he does have an ally, and he's going to be working to make that happen.
Oh, okay. Jim DeRuta, anything else on this?
Well, I think it'll be interesting to look and see what happens when it gets to the Senate.
Yeah.
And we've also heard from the president's advisors that in its current form, they would recommend that the president veto this.
Very interesting. Jim DeRuta is the editorial page editor of the New Bedford Standard Times. Thank you very much for explaining that and the other story about the Olympics.
Thank you, Sean.
Okay. On the phone, hanging on for us is Nelson Siegelman of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Hello, Nelson.
Good morning.
Good morning. Sorry to leave you hanging there with some really important news, I think, regarding New Bedford and the Olympics. And, of course, we're all interested in commercial fishing.
Sure.
Well,
a familiar story.
Chappaquiddick, this talk of putting a cell tower. I think there's been talk of putting a cell tower there before, but it's always controversial because of that island, where it is, right?
Yes, this is a long-running story. Cell phone service on Chappaquiddick is very spotty. It had been spotty in many places on the island, but a lot of that's been rectified with the recent addition of towers and also what they call a distributed antenna system, or DAS. Nantucket has one. These are small antennas placed on typically utility poles, and they're put in communities where people don't want to see a large tower. And the folks on Chappaquiddick had been hoping they could get a company to install a DAS system on Chappie. But when they issued a request for proposals, they received nothing because pretty much it's really a small number of people out there except in the summer, and there were no takers. Now this company, Grain Communications Group, has responded to another RFP, and they're willing to put up a 150 to 180-foot monopole. And then what they do is they lease space to cell phone companies, that sort of thing. And some people on Chappie are concerned about that. They don't want to see a tower. Others, I suppose, would be perfectly happy to have good cell phone communication. In some cases, it's a public safety issue as well. I don't. Some of your listeners may have heard yesterday afternoon a fellow had dug a hole in the sand on Norton Point Beach, and the hole collapsed on him, and there were some communication problems. So there are a lot of reasons for wanting to see cell phone communication improved out there.
And there's still a ways to go in terms of approvals. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, there's a whole review process and the permitting process. But the other point I should make is that local communities cannot typically stop a cell tower. The federal regulations prohibit people from small communities from blocking cell towers where there is an absolute need. So.
Let's talk about this interesting proposal regarding a low-cost car rental company potentially coming to Martha's Vineyard. Of course, there's the price, but also this concierge service, which would be part of this.
This was a sort of out-of-the-blue proposal. William Gately, he's a Boston businessman. He appeared before the Tisbury Selectmen last week, and he said he wants to provide low-cost rental car service. He said he'll be able to do it by providing used cars and also by using technology. People would rent the car through an application, an app, as they say. But the other part that attracted certainly my interest is he says he's going to offer a concierge service, but using it based in the Philippines. People would have, his Philippine employees, I guess, would have brochures and maps and be connected electronically. So if you come here from East Oshkosh, New York, and you're wandering around on State Road and you want to know where you can go and get a hamburger, I suppose you go onto your smartphone and talk to somebody sitting in a room in the Philippines, and they tell you where you can go and get your burger on Martha's Vineyard.
Very innovative idea. But the price for the cars themselves, he's talking about $50 a day.
Yeah, he says he's going to be able to have the cost. So there you go.
They're
in a competition.
All right. Nelson Siegelman, the editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Thank you, Nelson.
You're welcome.
Ann Brennan is here from the Cape Cod Times. And let's talk about in Barnstable, we could have pedicabs. Pedicabs are coming to Barnstable. So that's somebody who rides a bike and he's got something behind him. They pull you around behind, right?
Right. Yeah. And this is a pilot program that was approved earlier this week. At least the proposal with rules were approved this week for Barnstable, principally the village of Hyannis. And it allows Cape Cod pedicabs to operate, 5 pedicabs. They would operate from 6 a.m. to 2 a.m. in the morning. They could carry 3 passengers. And they want to see how it works. Town manager Thomas Lynch said, we'll see how it works through the end of the year.
Any price structure?
There is not a price structure. Customers would basically work the price out with their driver.
Really?
Right.
Oh, that'll be interesting at 1:30 in the morning.
Well, I believe this is the same way it works in Provincetown. They've had pedicabs for a few years. And in fact, Elizabeth Hartsgrove Gove, who now works for Barnstable, used to work for Provincetown, and she was the one that created the rules and regulations for Provincetown. So,
it may work just fine. I was in New York City not so long ago, and it was $3 a minute.
Wow.
Which,
you'd want a fast.
They looked like they were cruising. But,
right. But just to say, the only thing they have to get done now is to get their 5 or their number of drivers licensed, and they're hoping to do that so that they can start providing service June 22nd.
Okay. The former owner of the Falmouth Playhouse, Ralph Miller, has been convicted of money laundering. Now, heard the Falmouth Playhouse had burned, right?
Right. Well, this is Ralph Miller, as you said, who was convicted, but he was the former owner of the Falmouth Playhouse, which burned down while he was the owner of it. It turns out that was one of 3 theaters, playhouses that he owned, one in Woodstock, another in the Poconos, that burned down. went under his ownership. However, the charges that he was convicted of by a federal jury in Pennsylvania found that he had was guilty of one count of money laundering and one count of mail fraud in connection with insurance claims made after the Bucks County Playhouse that he owned in Pennsylvania, which was on the Delaware River, was damaged in a flood. He got almost $1 million from the insurance company because of the damages to that playhouse. It was $180 more than he should have received. He claimed that
$180,000
that he claimed light and other equipment had been damaged when in fact it hadn't been. But this and he faces up to 30 years in prison. This comes after years of people believing that he may have been involved with the arson, which the fire officials with the Falmouth Playhouse, which was a historic landmark.
Right.
Actors like Andy Rooney had come and performed there. That was determined to be an arson with an accelerant used to burn it down. A few years prior to that, the Woodstock Playhouse, which he owned, was also burned. Later, in 2009, the Pocono Playhouse burned to the ground. That one, Woodstock was determined to be an arson. Pocono is still not clear what may have caused that. He denies he had anything to do with the fires, but they always seem to happen when it was an economic downturn and he was in financial distress.
But and he wasn't convicted for that.
No, he was not convicted of that, but he is facing a serious...
Yeah, he's in trouble.
Right.
Okay.
Number of years in prison.
Last week on the roundup, we talked about a vote in the town of Mashpee where they had selected, I think they'd had 2 days of interviews for a new town manager. And then they, I think it was about a half hour after the final interview, they voted to approve the police chief as the new town manager in Mashpee. But there were some questions about whether that was a legitimate vote because of how it was posted or what was the question?
Right. So as you said, they voted, the board decided to vote to hire him as or pick him as the new town manager. Andrew Gottlieb, one of the selectmen, strongly advocated that they kind of take a while to think about this and not vote so quickly. But it turns out they did vote, and because that was not advertised on their agenda, it was most likely a violation of the state's open meeting law. So people have to understand what type of action the Board of Selectmen is going to take, or public officials, and so that these votes don't come up without the public having any voice in the matter, or at least to watch what's happening. So the town's lawyer said that we're going to have to take this vote again. They did. They did hire Chief Rodney Lewis, and then they met behind closed doors to discuss what his contract would look like, which is perfectly legal. And now they're moving forward. But the town lawyer said he's going to be holding seminars in the near future to refresh all town board members on the laws, regarding open meeting laws and in the near future, just so that this kind of thing doesn't happen again.
The Cape Cod Times did some follow-up on a story about a local doctor, who had gone into an agreement with the state licensing board saying he wouldn't practice. Some reporting by the Times reveals that he allegedly is practicing.
Well, it's not clear whether he is practicing, but he is still taking patients. There was somebody who taking new patients.
Well, what are you doing with them if you're taking
right.
those patients?
There was a person whose child is a patient of Dr. Tori Tolton, in Sandwich. He owns Sandwich Pediatrics with his wife, Dr. Marianne Koenig. And when she saw the reports that he was not going to be practicing under an agreement with the state, or at least, until this was figured out, she called the office and said, should I be changing to a pediatrician? And she was told that he's still accepting new patients, but he's out with an injury. So we talked to the state boards of registration, who would not comment directly about this case, but wrote a Maloney said that oftentimes it's the best way for the board to ensure the public safety is protected while an investigation is underway, that they come up with these agreements that the physician not be practicing or treating patients.
Very curious right. case. Thank you, Ann Brennan of the Cape Cod Times, for coming into the Woods Hole studio today. Appreciate it, Ann.
Thank you, Sean.
And you can follow Ann on Twitter at AnnBrennanCCT. And thanks to our other contributors, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Sally Rose of the Provincetown Banner, Jim DeRuta of the New Bedford Standard Times, and Nelson Siegelman of the Martha's Vineyard Times. If you know a local journalist you'd like to hear on the Roundup, have them get in touch with me. I'm Sean Corcoran. Thanks for listening.